Welcome to Transformative Talk, Critical Conversations for Teachers. I'm Dr. Zid Haddad, a professor of instruction within the Department of Interdisciplinary Learning and Teaching at the University of Texas at San Antonio. I teach undergraduate and graduate courses in curriculum and instruction. In short, I teach teachers how to teach and save lives through the use of critical multicultural education as an approach to teaching and learning. Our podcast is produced by a different group of graduate students each week, giving them an opportunity to talk about what they're reading in my class, what they experience in the field, and how that impacts their own lives and understandings. If you like what you hear, please subscribe to our podcast from wherever you're listening. Also, you can ask us questions and engage with us further using the anchor.fm website or the anchor.fm app on your phone. You can submit questions and you can also send us voice messages. And remember, please share our podcast on all your socials so that we can build our audience. Thanks for listening, and here's today's episode.
Go. So this is Andrea and Krista, your hosts for this episode of Transformative Talk. In this episode, we are going to focus on conocimiento, specifically in Nepantla. We will look at conocimiento as a process and educational tool for doctoral students in social sciences to better understand critical perspectives that form their research. Additionally, we will discuss how the process of testimonio brings to light the issue of oppression, both at macro and micro levels.
Yay! I love this topic. You know, as a school counselor, I think that a lot of the stuff in conocimientos really resonates, because it's like this process of acquiring knowledge and challenging your beliefs and challenging your perspectives, and like the human process of going through that in this like tug of war of, this is what I believe, this is what I've always believed, but now there's this new information that kind of sounds right too. And so it's pulling you in two different directions, and how do you navigate through that? And so I think that's what Gloria helped me out.
Anzaldúa.
was getting at when she created those stages of conocimiento is how do we navigate the waters whenever our beliefs and our perspectives and our background is challenged by things that we also believe, but they're in conflict with each other.
Right.
So anyway, that's, I think it's a pretty cool topic, and I'm glad we get a chance to talk about it today.
Yeah, it's a really interesting topic. It was for me personally, it was kind of like, oh, I have a word to describe that strange feeling that I did not know how to describe. And so that's what I really appreciated about these readings, and then about learning about the stages of conocimiento, is that it was there, like I sensed it in my life. I just didn't know how to describe it, and I didn't even know what to call it, especially Nepantla. That was when I like read about that word, and when I read what it meant, I was like, oh, hello. Like, hello.
Yep. that's it.
Yeah. And so I think it's a topic that definitely, regardless of, you know, like you knowing very much about Chicana feminism or the theory itself, regardless of that, I think that it's something that as PhD students, we can really relate to. And so I get something for us to talk about, and I guess discuss, is how this concept of conocimiento and Nepantla specifically, how it applies to students who are going through this program with us, especially with our main like focus in our program being about social justice. And so I know we had a response from one of our classmates. Do you want to share that?
Yeah. I know we had a couple questions about it. Somebody that addressed basically what you just said you went through as well. But yeah, one of our classmates says, I feel that these courses steer us towards Nepantla. Eventually, the goal is that all students come to this space where they begin to question the norms. And I know that I resonate with that response very much. I wasn't anticipating this feeling at all. And so I agree with you. Like whenever I read about what it was, like in my journal article, like right after I read about what Nepantla was, I was like, what a cool concept. I almost wish I would have read this paper earlier in my PhD program, so I would almost like anticipate that this is what's going to happen to me. I didn't I wasn't aware of how to deal with the contradictions between what's out there in society and what I've always learned and how that would make me feel. So I thought it was the same. I thought the same thing. And then we had that classmate that said the same thing. And then we had somebody else even say, I wonder if PhD programs have, if there's PhD programs out there that help guide students through their journey. My response to that is I think actually participating in these classes, doing the journals, doing the reflections, like that is the process itself. I don't know if there needs to be an external thing that we go through. I think the more you participate in class discussions, the more you really, really kind of dive into your reflection or your testimonial. That is the process of going through conocimientos and dealing with that feeling of nepantla.
Right. And I think a lot of the time, to put it really simply, you know, we don't know what we don't know. And so it's hard to know what we don't know, because if we don't know it, we don't know it. And so that was the case with me, especially the first year, where I was like, oh my gosh, like I had never even thought about even basic things like, are the songs I'm teaching in my class culturally relevant? And it looking back, it feels so ignorant, you know? But at the same time, like if I didn't know, like if nobody ever told me, if I never like opened my eyes to that, if I was never checked in like pedagogical practices, how would you know? And so that's kind of the same situation here. I think a lot of the time we go through this journey and we don't even know that's what's happening and how like our classes are shaping us to do that. Like they're changing us, right? In a good way. So what I agree with you about like, oh, I wish I had known about this earlier, because then I would feel maybe a little bit less lost throughout it, you know, like, oh, like I feel so like heavy or I feel so weighted by this. And so I think that it's definitely something that helps people when you actually like when you learn it and you know it and you're like, oh, this explains it all for me. You know, this explains why I've been the way I've been feeling. And so yeah, I think that it's definitely something that at least should be learned. But I agree with you. I don't know that we need like extra guidance, because I think at least in our program, the classes are structured in a way that it's felt gradual for me. And so I think that's a really good thing.
I agree. I mean, I kind of go back to like, should this be introduced earlier or kind of the middle of the program? Like we've kind of got it in the middle. We've been hearing things that have been questioning it, and we've had this internal dialogue in our head, but then we actually learned what that internal dialogue is here about, halfway through our program. Would it have been beneficial to learn it earlier? I don't know. I've kind of gone back and forth in my head. It's like when you're doing a lesson in class, and sometimes you kind of introduce concepts on purpose at the beginning. And then there's an aha moment later because you learned all this stuff and it challenged your thoughts. And so then you get the aha moment. So I don't know. I was kind of wondering, like, wonder why this class that addresses conocimientos and the nepantla, like, why is that now in the middle? And that's kind of where I got to is that so it allows us to have this like aha moment of where we're at because we've gone through some of the stages already. Whereas if you just learn it ahead of time, like you might take it for granted. And I don't know. I don't think we would get that same emotional tie to it, like this. Oh, I've everybody else is feeling this too, and this is what it is, and it's normal. And anyway, so I think it's kind of cool that it's here halfway through, and we can tie in this dialogue we've been having with ourselves this whole time.
Yeah, I agree. And it also helps, I think it just helps us mature a little bit in what we're talking about, because we're talking about really serious topics in our classes. And so I think that knowing about this now rather than before is maybe an asset for that.
Definitely, definitely. And I'm sure that as we go through this process that it's very taxing, because I think a lot of us are probably in the stages of nepantla, just looking at the journals from our classmates where they're kind of torn, and there's stages that are going to come later where we kind of come to terms with that and develop some mindfulness of how we've changed, and we start to accept ourselves with these new perspectives and these new beliefs that challenged our old belief systems. But it is very taxing. I feel like it's very draining, because it's hard to sit there and double guess what you've known all along and the beliefs that you grew up around. And I find it very emotionally draining. I don't know if you have that same feeling.
Oh, it is. Because it's a lot. It's just a lot, to think about, like, you following something and doing something maybe like your entire life, and then realize like, oh, maybe that wasn't right.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for me, what was my moment of like, oh my gosh, for that, was realizing, I did a project last semester about culturally sustaining pedagogy for music education. And I had not even realized like how much in the system I was, like, as a piano student in high school, and like then going to college and all the things, you know. And I had no idea, like, I just didn't realize any of the things that were very problematic, and I just didn't know. And so, like, for example, the fact that if I didn't learn specific repertoire, like if I didn't learn Beethoven, for example, for an audition, like then I literally can't even audition for college. So,
wow.
You know, like specific composers, which there's nothing wrong with those composers, but there are also other countless of composers that maybe, like, as a Latina teenager, I might have related to a little bit more, but those are not acceptable for auditions. And so something like things like that, for example, I didn't even think about it. You know, my teacher told me, oh, you got to learn this. And I was like, all right, like, got to learn this. That's on the list for what I need to learn. And then last semester, I just like was looking back and I was like, oh my gosh, like, this is considered the standard. And that's unfortunate, because there's a lot of other really cool music from other cultures and other people, and we don't play them because they're not considered the standard. And so I think that was, for me, that was like when I looked back at like my educational experience and I was like, wow, you know, like, I thought I had a good one. And that's not to say that I didn't have a good one, but maybe it could have been better if the system had allowed it to be.
If the standardization wasn't in place already. Yeah. Yeah. But it wasn't a diverse standardization at all.
Yeah. Sure. And so it makes you really question everything, really, like looking back and questioning everything. And then I think that ties into our next topic of like testimonio, because you live with your testimony for your whole life. And so you realizing these things about your education or your culture or your home life or whatever the case, later, once you go through this process and you realize maybe things weren't quite what they should have been, that changes your testimonial. And so I really liked what one of our classmates said, where she said, I related to this, the concept of testimonial, because I feel like I am in a million pieces trying to discover my identity. And I feel like that's a super fitting way to describe the process of shaping your testimonial. I don't know. What do you think?
No, that definitely. I think this also is a part of one of the seven stages of conocimientos too, where you feel like you're broken up into many pieces and you have to find a way to reconstruct those. And maybe you use pieces you didn't before, or you might have to toss away pieces that no longer fit with your perspective. But I think the process of testimonio is something that not only we as like doctoral students have to do, but something as educators, we have to get our students to participate in as well. Of course, that has to be, we have to keep in mind the age of the students and developmentally appropriate ways of doing that. But the process of testimony is very, very powerful. And it's not just saying, this is what I grew up in, and this is what I believe, and this is the way it is, but it's really like introducing people to other perspectives. So like in class the other day, we saw the video of Sokotoa. I had never heard of that before, but apparently it's a thing
I
for
had never
learning.
heard that. I was like, oh my God,
I
this
had
is
no idea, but I could totally see, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, like that being like the way to learn those trigonometric concepts of cosine, sine, and tangent. I could see that as being like, this is a cool way to engage your kids and get them involved, and especially if you learn it around November. When we watched that, and I had a second to like reflect on that and what it might mean to the kids sitting in that classroom, not only the ones that are Native American, but just the other students in there and their now impressions of what Native American culture is, it kind of threw me off. And then today I was online and I saw like all these videos and pictures of kids at school who had like Thanksgiving celebrations this past week at school, because it was the last week before the break. And they're all wearing like their headbands with like a turkey on it. And I'm like, at some point in time, we have to introduce like what this day represents and the historical concept of it, like, and give kids a second to have their own testimonial about it. But if we just continue to, make it a turkey day and or a turkey headband, and I don't know if kids ever really get a chance to shape and discuss their own testimonial on subjects like that.
Yeah, and
So.
I find there's like a lot of room. There's not a lot of room, even in my experience, there's just not a lot of room even in schools where of like providing a space for children to share their own, like what parts of what may be their own testimonial. We as teachers, I think, make a lot of assumptions. I know I definitely do. And it's something that's a struggle because you have to constantly be like, okay, just because that's you doesn't mean that's them, and just because that's the majority maybe doesn't mean that's everybody. And so I think it's important to talk about like this concept of testimonial even with younger students, because they should really be aware of that, like their experiences matter. And the things that they are experiencing matter, and they really shape who you become and who you are. And so if we're not actively like telling the kids, hey, like your culture matters, your experience matters, all of these things matter, and they are why you're you. If we're not doing that, then I don't imagine that it's easy to do that as an adult.
No, I mean, we're struggling with it. I'm sure they would have a hard time too. And then, and the hard thing from student teacher education perspective is making sure that the environment is safe to have those conversations. Like, true testimonial can't happen if you feel like you're going to be judged for it. So it has to be a super safe environment. Got to have parents that are okay with introducing these ideas, which brings another level of complexity to everything. So it is a much needed thing in the school system, so that students can not only learn their own perspectives, but start to take in the perspective as others. But the only way that can happen is if the environment is truly safe, non-judgmental, and that the parents are on board with that, which is challenging. But anyway, and we also have to understand that not everybody's going to be in the same place. I know there was a point in time this semester in our class where one of our classmates pointed out a great thing. They said, we're not all in the same place on this. Like, if you look at the stages, some people are on a different stage than others. And it reminded me, like, whenever you see a kid who's struggling in the classroom, we say, you got to meet them where they are. Like, you're going to have kids up here and you're going to have kids down here, and you have to meet them where they are and help them get to the next level. You can't just assume that everybody's at the same place. Because that's where people start to fall behind, and they get frustrated, right? So that like reminded me of this when our classmates said, we're not all in the same place. Like, some of us are going to go through the process of conocimiento slower, their testimonial doesn't look like mine. And we can't judge on that. We got to realize that there's not a time frame on a lot of this, and it's fluid, it's changing, it's evolving, and we've got to give people time for reflection. It just doesn't just happen.
Yeah, and you know, I just thought of this as you were talking about that. Like, if you are maybe just getting by, right? Like you're just going through your life, like you go to school, high school, you graduate, you get a job, and you just like, you know, continue to work and support yourself and support your family or whatever. Does this ever happen? Like this whole transformation, I guess. Or is it ever introduced, right? Like, is it ever, I don't know. Do you know what I mean though? Like, does this transformation need probing from an outside force, you
Oh,
know?
that's an interesting concept. Like, is it possible for us to go through it on our own?
I don't know.
Now, yeah, I mean, I'm wondering. I don't know. I mean, I know some people just, that I know from my community or whatever, and I think they would be less likely to go through the stages of conocimientos to have their testimonial questioned, right? To write a new testimonial, just because they have heard the same thing generation after generation after generation. It's been supported by their environment. They've never had anybody show them another perspective. And
Right.
so it's not, and if somebody does, there's somebody near them who questions it, and it's somebody that they trust who questions it and criticizes other perspectives. So then they go along with it because the person I'm trusting doesn't agree with this, so therefore I won't either. But I think if you're somebody who grew up in an area that's more diverse, and you've seen more perspectives, and you've heard of stories that are different than yours, and you've seen it, experienced it, are friends with people, you're more likely to be able to go through this process naturally than others who maybe didn't grow up in a diverse location. I don't know.
Yeah, it's just like a, I guess a wonder, you know?
I don't know. Yeah, I don't know. Is it
Didn't
a
know that there's
natural
a wonder.
thing or
I
not?
didn't know. Yeah. So something to think about for sure.
Definitely, definitely. So, if we're going to spend some time thinking, I think we're going to take a little break. And when we come back, we'll talk about how testimonial might change your perspective on the oppressed. You're up.
All right, so welcome back to this week's transformative talk. I'm Andrea here with Krista, and so we're going to continue talking about testimonial and how this can be viewed as with our perspectives on oppression or being oppressed. And so something that we're going to get started with is just kind of discussing different types of testimonial, something that we notice as looking through various dialogue journals. And so Krista, do you want to kind of start us off with that?
Sure. So when we were kind of looking through our classes journals on their readings, what we noticed was that two types of testimonial showed up. Either testimonial where somebody either recognized their own oppression from the readings, or they already knew that they were oppressed and they were able to use the journal articles as a way to reflect upon that, share their feelings. And then there was the other form of testimonial where the person themselves wasn't oppressed, but they were able to recognize either their contribution to other people's oppression, or they become aware of other people's oppression through the readings and the dialogue that we had in class. So we thought that was kind of interesting, that testimonial isn't just necessarily about a reflection of your own oppression, but that recognizing that the oppression exists with other people as well. So, like one of our classmates, when she was reading some of the readings this year, kind of it brought to light something that we thought was really interesting. She said, You know, there when she first arrived in the States, she went to visit one of her friends here, and she arrived at the apartment by a bus. And the person who answered the door called out to her friend, said, "Hey, there's somebody here. The maid has arrived," is what she described as the student. "The maid has arrived." She's like, "You know, in my home country, I'm a college professor, but here I'm a maid just based on my appearance, how I arrived at the apartment." And so she was able to recognize and use the journal as a way of testifying her oppression that she went through. And I thought that was very sad. Like, this is somebody who, you know, I can't believe that somebody would just, you know, judge her right away just based on her appearance without having a single conversation with her. It had to make her feel really, you know, I don't know, very judged.
Yeah, and I think so. I thought of it as you said. That made me really sad because it is really sad. But also us thinking like, oh gosh, that's so sad. Like that's also our privilege. Our privilege, you know, like because like we're like, I can't believe that would happen. Because I respond that way too. I'm like, oh my gosh, I can't believe people can be so mean, or I can't believe this. But then it's also like, well, it's because we are like in an educational system where we've been taught, you know, that that's not right. That's not okay. And so, you know, talking about like forms of oppression and privilege and things like that shows our privilege as well, right? Like us looking at that and being like, oh gosh, like that's terrible. And it is. It's terrible. But that thought doesn't even cross other people's minds that that's terrible, maybe. And it's because it could be for a lot of reasons, but another part of it is also maybe the lack of education, right? Of that. And so I think that happens a lot with looking at people and seeing them one way that is different than their rea than reality, right? Than who they actually are. One, this is like a small example, and it's not really an example of oppression, but like, for example, every time I tell somebody I'm from Laredo, they assume I speak Spanish. And then I feel really bad because I don't.
Because you don't? Oh no, right? You're
Because I
like,
don't. And I understand Spanish really well, but I just never had to speak it. And so then I feel bad because I'm like, oh, like I don't fit the mold that they expected me to fit. You know what I mean? And so just because of where I'm from, or because of how I talk, or because of my name, or how I introduced myself, because I said Andrea instead of Andrea, you know, I don't know. And so I think that this has a lot to do with like our intersectionality, right? And it has a lot to do with how people view us, just like our friend who, you know, they saw her and they were like, oh, the maid. It's not even thinking, right, about she could be anybody. You know, she could just be a friend, she could be a guest, she can be anybody. And so I think that that happens a lot, especially with all groups of people, honestly, because I was going to say it happens a lot with minority groups, but that's not true because it happens a lot with everybody. Just the stereotype is different.
Well, I mean, I think that there's some truth to that for sure. In terms of, I think it doesn't happen with minority groups, probably more so
Than non-minority groups, dominant groups. I think there's some truth to that for sure. And I think that example that you gave about Spanish speaking is very true here regionally, in the San Antonio area. I have gotten to a point where I've become more self-aware of that. You know, I think when I first started teaching, I was probably one of those people that would do that. Hey, do you speak Spanish? Because I would need somebody that it could help. And I didn't go to the white teacher next door because I made an assumption and a stereotype that they wouldn't be able to. And so I'm very cognizant of that and choose my words very wisely when I'm asking that specific question because I don't want to hurt anybody's feelings. But I know at some point in time, 10 years ago, that was me and that was wrong. But like we have a new student on my campus who just arrived here from Mexico 3 weeks ago, doesn't know any Spanish at all. And so there's like a group of us constantly trying to help him. And so whenever and I do my best. I know a little Spanish, not a ton, you know, and I see a lot of the students that do speak Spanish laugh at me because it's bad Spanish, but I can get where I need to get most time. But I'm very particular about who I ask, you know, like I'll make sure I look around. Does anybody here speak Spanish that can help me? And I won't like make eye contact with like a certain person, because I don't want them to get that feeling. But I'm sure that that resonates over and over again in the school system, in the grocery store. Like that's probably an example that can be used, that is very generalized. It can be used in a lot of different settings, of a form of oppression. So anyhow, that was a good example. But do you feel so? Have you ever talked about that in like your testimonial and your journals? Is that something that maybe you have discussed?
It's definitely something that I don't know that I've expressed it in my journals. I probably have at some point, but mm-hmm. It's definitely something for like our end of the year project that I'm hyper-focusing on because okay. I've always felt like not quite Mexican enough, also not American enough, because if I go outside of this general area, really, like just the way I talk, I have an accent, you know, like I say a lot of word, like tortilla, I say tortilla, you know, like I've always said it like that. I didn't know that people said it tortilla. I didn't know. but you know, like stuff like that. Like I went to a summer camp one time in high school, and it was in Waco. And so it was a piano camp. And so they were serving barbacoa for breakfast, and they were like, "Oh, we have barbacoa." And I was like, "What is that?"
Oh no.
They were like barbacoa. And I was like, "I don't know what that is." And then it clicked, and I was like, "Oh."
Who's been saying it wrong the whole time, right?
I was like, "Barbacoa?" And they were like, "Barbacoa? What? You say it like that?" And I was like, I didn't know there was another way to say it. You
like,
know?
You say it like that? Like,
I don't know.
Yeah. You could say that to each other.
Yeah. So it's this awkward, like, it's just this awkward in betweenness, right? Because it's like, I've always said things like that, or I've always followed a certain culture, but then I don't speak Spanish, but that doesn't, mm-hmm. that doesn't make me less, right? Of any part of culture or identity that I have. And so that's definitely something. I feel like I've been especially working through this year, honestly, because it started with our autoethnography in Dr. Ryan's class, and so then it's just kind of progressed since then. So it is a thing, that's for sure.
Yeah. And so even like Dr. Ryan's autoethnography that you mentioned, even that I would guess would be like a form of testimonial. We see like people using different formats to tell their story. I know we have a classmate who definitely feels oppressed. Is very vocal about it, and I think we get a lot of good stuff from the things that she shares in her perspectives. And what I've noticed is that her testimonial isn't always like in the written form. She finds poetry, like recorded poetry, or artwork, these types of things, like that was what resonates with her and helps her tell her story. So I think we all have a different way of sharing, you know, our story. Mm-hmm. So yours, maybe you started there in your autoethnography. Hers is, you know, poetry and art and all these different things that I didn't realize could serve as that. But in addition to it serving as a way of telling our own oppression, I think a lot of us have gotten out of the different forms of testimonial that we've used is that it's a way to recognize the oppression of others, the groups that we don't belong to, but that it's important for us to realize that they're oppressed too. I know I've just shared an example of that, you know, a minute ago, and there's lots of classmates that have shared examples of that throughout the year as well.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's really like the next step of it. You know, it's much easier. I think personally for me, it is easier mm-hmm. for me to see, oh, somebody like treated me racist or did not treat me right, like, oh, I was oppressed in that moment. It's much easier to identify that, I think, than it is to step outside and look at other people's. And I think it's because it makes us uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And it does. It is uncomfortable. And that's, it's not a question of like, should it be uncomfortable or should it not? It's uncomfortable no matter what, because mm-hmm. it's uncomfortable to see people treated unfairly. And so I think that it's that next step really is like stepping outside of your bubble of oppression and seeing like, okay, these are how other people are affected, you know, and yeah. This is also not right.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that some of our classmates throughout the year have witnessed that, you know, because we haven't just focused on like one group of people. We've been focusing on all kinds of different groups of people, and none of us belong to all of those groups. So we've had a chance to step back and realize, oh, you know, I've felt oppressed or marginalized belonging to this group, but I never even thought about, you know, this group over here I don't belong to. And there's been connections though too. So even though I'm, you know, not oppressed because I don't belong to this group, I still have the same feelings and emotions. It just looks a little different to me. So like one of our classmates talked about, you know, I think it was when we were talking about queer studies, they said, you know, I failed to notice that this was even a possible issue. What I've learned has been through what I've seen on different television shows and stuff like that. And so I didn't even realize that was an issue. Thought that the LGBTQ plus community was a very like tight-knit group, but even within that group, because of intersectionality, there's layers of oppression that exist. And there's other examples, you know, like a student who talked a lot about not realizing the struggles of the indigenous populations. And I know that last week we had some great conversation in class about that, because, you know, yeah. That's a group that many of us don't belong to, but learning about the things that they struggle with in terms of just like access to water, food, electricity, education in some places, it's a whole nother level that we didn't even know existed. Mm-hmm. And I think it kind of united us a little bit in class last week, because I don't think any of us were part of that group. So we were all kind of going through the same process together. So yeah, I thought that was kind of interesting.
Yeah, that is interesting. I hadn't realized that none of us were part of that group. I mean, obviously none of us are Native American, you know, in class.
Yeah.
But the way you put it was like really, really nicely. Like it helped kind of get us all together, especially looking at a group that we are not a part of and seeing like their oppression, and then seeing how maybe in some small ways we might contribute to that. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, I think that's really powerful.
Well, one thing that I'm curious of, as we've talked in class a lot about all these different marginalized groups, right? Race, gender, indigenous populations, queer studies. One thing that's kind of come to light is I'm curious if it's possible not to belong to an oppressed group at all. So, I mean, you could step back and be like, well, yeah, if you're a white male, non-indigenous, straight, then you wouldn't be oppressed, right? But mm-hmm. I'm wondering if there's like those big groups that we studied, would those be considered like macro groups? But are there micro groups exist that also experience oppression, like on a, maybe I don't want to say a lower level, but it's just not as recognized. Like I'm thinking of kids from single parent homes, non-English speakers, the elderly, maybe mentally ill, right? Or even like some physical disability too. Are there micro forms of oppression? And if they are, I'm sure that every single one of us is oppressed to some degree, but obviously those degrees would probably be, you know, on a continuum of some sort.
Right. And I think of like the Wheel of Power thing that has been shared a lot in class.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The expanding circle with all of the different forms of privilege and power, basically. And so I think that definitely those individual elements, those like micro levels that you were talking about, you know, like your health or where you live or financials or language, you know, all of those things absolutely play a role. And I think that I don't know the answer to your question.
Yeah.
But I do think that it is very difficult to, and I don't want to say ignore because that's not what we're doing, but to discount like the history of power, right? Mm-hmm. And like the history of oppression for certain groups of people, and not necessarily just like race and gender and ethnicity, but like you were saying, like all of those small things, because there have been all types of oppression for, like, for example, disabled mm-hmm. or like people with mental disabilities or things like that. There have been decades of oppression, and so I think that plays a really big role, like the generational oppression that has occurred for certain groups of people, both at the macro and the micro level. I think that's really important to think about.
Yeah. I mean, I think that probably to some degree, yeah, everybody's experienced it, you know, in some form or fashion, for sure. Which then brings to question, like, should we focus more on humanizing? Should we focus more research on humanizing, right? How do we make people, I don't want to say we can't make everybody feel like equals, because that's not right. That's false advertising. We're not all equals right now. But how do we like humanize curriculum so that it's not just focused on one area or another, but where we all feel equally represented, our voices are heard, that we get a chance to say what we need to say, but also feel like people are hearing what we're saying, and that we're all equally represented. Because it's hard to be a teacher and be sure that every single, you know, group is represented every single day and every single lesson. Like, that's, I don't know how you do that using, like, if you're an English teacher, you can't find a book that addresses all of the possible groups at one time. So how do we like humanize curriculum? Because we can't do that every single day, every single time, in terms of like culturally sustaining or culturally relevant curriculum. Why can't it be like humanizing curriculum? Or does that then take away, if we do that, does it take away the voices of the oppressed? Like,
I feel like it's tough. One of our classmates talked about this concept, and they said, when we other someone, we dehumanize them. I feel like children follow the scripts they learn in the home and begin othering very early. They are taught to see others as not quite human, not the same, but we are all human and students and need to be able to see everybody else as a human. I think it would solve a lot of our issues if humanization was taught from birth. And so I think that's interesting, because that's kind of a different approach than what you had suggested, right? Of doing it in curriculum, but of like more of a societal issue, right? Like of the humanization needing to start from day one rather than you learn this in school. But unfortunately for many of our students, and I actually talked about this in my journal for this particular topic, for many of our students, their school is their home. Mm-hmm. And that's the only home they really have. And so I think that it's not so easy to say, oh, they just got to do it at home. Because that's a lot of responsibility on the parent. And unfortunately, kids don't always have parents, or somebody to take care of them. And so then it's the responsibility of teachers and of educators and of the other, their librarians or whoever, you know, their coach, their soccer coach, wherever they are interacting with an adult. And so I think then that kind of ties into what you were saying about like the responsibility really lies also on educators. But it's challenging because educators are not the ones responsible really for what they teach most of the time. And there are very few areas in schools and in like academic or even non-academic subjects where you have control over what you teach. It's a little bit more flexible with like electives and fine arts and things like that. You know, like I don't have a curriculum that I follow as a music teacher. However, for example, my kids are preparing for UIL solo and ensemble. So they have to pick solos. And I have a very specific list that they have to pick solos from because UIL will provide like this specific list. That's my list. And so if my list has no brown or black, you know, composers, that's what it is. And so then what do I do? Do I not give these kids the opportunity to do this because the music is not relevant to them? Or do I just have to continue with this system because that's the only thing I can do for them to do this opportunity to begin with, which many of them don't ever get this opportunity, you know? And so, even in fields where you have more liberty, it's still there.
Yeah. And so
that's what I think is frustrating about it, because it's easy to say like, oh, well just do more Latina songs with your Latino kids, you know, but I can't because I gotta follow certain things as well. And so I think that it's very complicated and it's very hard for teachers. And it's even harder, I think, for teachers who are a little bit more scrutinized than maybe I am as a music teacher.
Like maybe social studies teachers, right. Stuff like that, right? Like they're the ones who could introduce several of these concepts because it's rooted in history, but they're blocked in. Right. So yeah, I think that's definitely true. It can start at home, but we can't guarantee it will. And then when they get to school, then there's like some policy hindrances there that prevent it. One place where it could potentially, I'm talking about all of it, like culturally sustainable pedagogy, humanizing efforts, all of this, one place that some of that could come in would be this big word of SEL learning that's been coming out a lot lately. I mean, there's a lot of talk on social emotional learning. I know state of Texas, TEA passed, legislation about required character education programs that now have to be put in, that have to be taught at least once per kind of campus, I guess. I think they do like they group grade levels together kind of thing. But it's interesting that the state is having a big push for social emotional learning and the need for that. And I think there's humanizing efforts there. So maybe that's a location where some of this can be implemented, because it's going to have all like, yes, there's TEKS behind it. Like they have put TEKS in the character education program requirements, but there's some flexibility in implementation where maybe some of this can finally be put into the classroom and follow policy at the same time. Wouldn't that be kind of interesting? So
yeah, interesting. I mean, like in theory, as many things to do, it sounds great. We have like once a month, I think they call them guidance lessons, I think it's what you're talking about, like where they have them all together. And the kids think it's like the most ridiculous thing ever, which is really unfortunate, because that's the space where this needs to happen. And so then I don't know, like, is the question then like, how do we change the mindset of it? You know what I mean? Because I think to students, and then I'm sure some teachers, to be honest, it's viewed as like, oh, gonna go do our thing, you know, gonna go do our drug awareness prevention, you know, like And then the kids are there and they're like, oh, got to hear this woman talk to me, you know? So I think then we still need the support of everybody on the campus, really, to be like, this is important. And our kids actually need this, like they really do. But it's only beneficial if they are open-minded and are actually listening, because sitting in the room and hearing it means nothing if they don't do anything. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Like they've got to go through the testimonial, right? Like we're going to wrap it back to that again. Yeah. I mean, they've got to hear it and they've got to engage with it. But how do you make people go through the process of testimonial? It's like what you said earlier, right? Like, is it naturally inherent? Could it be a naturally inherent process that somebody could engage in on their own, or does it require external probing, right? Well, in this case, if we're talking about kids in the educational system, it might be like there's a little push that's needed, and maybe not just from one person. It might have to be more, not just, I mean, societal, yes, but in terms of campuses, that everybody's got to be on board with it, which means that they maybe needed to have gone through it ahead of time and seen transformative change themselves to realize the impact of it, so that they can then pass it down to the next generation of students in their classroom. And it's going to be even more necessary as students start to recognize, I think that students are starting to recognize and become more aware of like changes in gender norms and racism in education and like all these topics that most of the adults talked about, right? Now the students are. And so it becomes even more needed as they become more aware of it.
Yeah, no, that is definitely true. I look at my students, I teach high school. And so I look at my high schoolers and they're so like, they're just so woke, you know, for a better lack of a better way of saying it. But I think of myself when I was in high school and I'm just like, oh my gosh, like I was so not as with it as you all are. Which is hopeful, I think, because they see what's not right, or they are starting to see what's not right, and they don't like it, and they shouldn't like it, you know, because if it's not right, then it's not right. But it definitely makes it challenging to be in an authoritative place and to have like a good balance of power, you know, as a teacher or an administrator or whatever, with students who are very knowledgeable. And so it's navigating those like systems of power, right? And so that way that you can have these conversations with them and it's still respectful and it's still helping them get to where they need to be.
Yeah, definitely. It's going to continue to be a challenge, but hopefully one that we continue to make progress on, that we continue to generate change. So anything else you want to add?
I don't think so. I think that's all for this episode, right?
Okay, I think so.
Great.
Well, thanks for listening. And remember, if you want to support what we do, then share, subscribe, and leave a review wherever you discover our show. That's all for now, but we'll see you in the next episode of Transformative Talk. Bye.